Well, it is another beautiful Meltdown Monday. Welcome all over the world to all our incredible Meltdown peeps. I'm over here repping it in Manchester, UK. It's your boy. It's the Tomcat, Tom Finkel, ready to go. And as it has been for the past 3 weeks, Manchester has been all sunny. So I've got business up top, party downstairs as we're literally rocking the shorts. It's been a good day, and it's always a good day when I'm joined by my big brother over the pond. But we are blessed with greatness. We are blessed today with someone who is so outrageous, it's contagious. Ladies and gentlemen, as I'm going to bat it over to the big AZ, it's a good day out there. It's a good day in America. It's a good day to be back.
Welcome, YouTube universe, to the sixth episode of The Meltdown with the Tomcat of Manchester and yours truly. Our special guest today is a friend of mine who has an incredible resume in amateur boxing and professional wrestling that includes a former New York Golden Gloves for three consecutive years, a Pro Wrestling Rookie of the Year, a three-time WCW television champion, a WWF Intercontinental champion, and has an Amazon best-selling book, Bad to Good. He is not only a champion inside of the ring, but a champion in life. Our guest today contributes much of his time to his organization, Champion of Choices, as a motivational speaker, which empowers youth to make a positive change in their lives. He travels internationally, spreading his powerful message. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome the one and only Mark Merrow.
Wow, my gosh. I haven't had an introduction like that in a long time. Oh, my gosh, you guys. Thank you. It's great to be here. I've been excited about this podcast. Brian and I go way back. I'm talking over 30 years ago. And Tom, it's great to see you, man. Let's get into it, man. Let's have some fun. Let's dig into some deep questions. And obviously, I've been on a book tour promoting my book, Bad to Good. And it's been incredible.
Well, it was wonderful meeting you in Manchester. I hope the beautiful arms of the UK public wraps themselves around you as you promoted the incredible book, Bad to Good, co-written by our very good friend, Mr. Ben Veal. We'll send out big props to you, big fella. It was great to see you over in Manchester. But yes, we've throw that book up there, Brian. That's it. We want to get as much airtime as we can.
I am working my way through it. Yes, absolutely. Woo.
It's looking so good, so pretty that I had to order it twice. Beautiful. Now, thank you so much.
Oh, hush, Tommy. Or I kick your booty with my tutti frutti.
There it goes.
We've been waiting for that. I can die happy now. We love it. But today we're going to be dissecting lots of Mark's career when he was in WCW. So we're going to take it back to the Tutti Frutti days. It's going to be all about Johnny B. Badd today, as well as Mark's life now and his beautiful book, Bad to Good. So that's exactly what we're going to be featuring on today's episode of The Meltdown. It is a big one. It's one that we have been chomping at the bit to get at. However, just before we begin to take a nice big deep dive into the career of the legendary Mark Merrow, I just want to send out big love and support to a brother that we lost this past weekend. And I'm going to bat it over to you guys to just get your thoughts, just get a few words about the icon that is Sabu.
Yeah. Again, unfortunately, we found out on Sunday, really sad news. My interactions with him were always as nice as could be. He was really a sweetheart of a guy, very quiet, but always approachable. I met him back in SummerSlam 2021, I think, in Las Vegas. And then again, this past month in Vegas. So yeah, it was just really sad news, and too bad. And we're definitely going to miss him.
You know, it's a tragedy. I mean, he's 60 years old. It just seems so young now, you know. And I was blessed that I got to see him at a wrestling convention not too long ago. And we were both staying at the Marriott, and we just happened to run each other in the lobby. We just hung out, man. And it was like we just had a great conversation about he was really really talked to me about what I've been doing now and what he's doing. And of course the injuries, that guy is, when you talk about giving your life to this business, there's probably not a better example of someone that gave it all and then gave some more. Yeah. And I was just blessed to be able to really just sit and just chat with him about life, man. And that was pretty cool. And I always remember that. And that's a picture I posted on social media of us in the lobby at the Marriott. And, you know, it's tough, Brian. I mean, we've known so many people that we've worked with or against that are no longer here. It's a tough business, man. I mean, we're talking off the air, you and I, about the injuries that we've had. Yeah. And it's not even injuries. You talk about surgeries now. You know, I don't know. I've had 14, and I'm sure you're right up there with as many or more. It's incredible. And it takes its toll on your body. But when you talk about the epitome of giving your life, there's no one at that top of the list other than Sabu.
Sending all our condolences from the Meltdown family to the family of the legendary Sabu. It's up there for you, brother. It's up there. Well, Brian, I'm going to pass over to you. You're going to start our show off, and we've got some absolutely scintillating questions to dig in.
Yeah, Mark had mentioned how far we go back, and we really do. I was thinking about it, and there were some of the times that, you know, we would run into each other at the original power plant. Like there were three versions of the power plant, and I'm sure that Mark would probably had visited all three of those with yours truly here. But I know that you were originally trained by the Malenkos. But my question was, how much really training did you get from Sarge and, of course, Jody Hamilton at the power plant?
Well, you know, fortunately, I got to go down to the power plant and work with Sarge and Jody Hamilton. I love Jody Hamilton was the best. I mean, great. he was the epitome of the gorilla position. Before you go out to the ring, you'd see him. And he didn't have a lot of words, but when he did speak, man, you listened. But Sarge was a machine. And luckily, I've always been in really good condition. And because I've watched Sarge, we'd start off with like 500 Hindu squats. And I just watch guys drop. And these are guys that come in from maybe the NFL or, you know, different other sports that were thought they were in great shape. But man, he'd run guys out of that power plant. And you had to be ready to go because he was tough, man. He was tough. Because he was in such great condition, and luckily I could hang with him, and so he always respected me. And we went on the road to have matches against each other because he was teaching me and learning. You know, the thing I think, Brian, that a lot of people don't realize, that when I went to Malenko's, you know, I never had a match yet, you know, and then I slowly just had a couple independent matches. And then, of course, driving up to WCW and hope to be picked to be one of the guys that gets beat up by the superstars on television for $150. I would drive 9 hours, hopefully to get picked. And that's how my career started. And then obviously once I got into the WCW, that's when I started going to the power plant because I really knew how to wrestle. And I did Arn Anderson's podcast not too long ago, and he was another guy they put on the road.
I caught that,
And he would say, that man, he goes, Johnny B. Badd doesn't know the difference between a wrist watch and a wrist lock. You know, so I definitely went to the power plant to learn how to wrestle.
Well, it was a beautiful process. I mean, as you got there and you perfected all your skills, what was the process like of receiving your contract? How did your family react to get?
Well, you know, I often tell the story that after my first match, when I was chosen to be on television, and it was against Doom. I mean, here I am, my first time, and I only had a couple of matches under my belt at this time. I didn't really know much. And I'm wrestling Doom, another world tag team champions, you know? So me and another wrestler were against Doom, and that guy's, they were stiff. They were rough. And it's funny, I just did a conference with Ron Simmons, and he was sitting at the table next to me, and we had the absolute best time. Because, you know, our history goes, here he is, my first match. And then down the road, I'd win the Intercontinental title, beating him in the finals of the tournament that I was in. But back then, I kind of messed up the finish of the ending because I thought that I had to get out of the ring real quick. So I kind of got up a little too fast. And anyways, long story short, Butch Reed was very, very angry. And Brian, if you remember that, there were two dressing rooms at center stage. It was kind of where the enhancement guys would dress. And then there's the dressing room where the superstars would dress. And it was customary for the superstars to come over to the enhancement and thank them for the match and so on, you know?
Right.
And so I didn't realize how much I screwed up in the match. And I'm waiting for them to kind of come in. And I hear Butch Reed swearing, F this, F that. And I hear the door get kicked open. And he comes right at me. And he's just like, you effing idiot. You know, who do you think you are? You're so damn green. You don't even know when we beat you. You know, they do they pick you up on your shoulder, the clothesline off the top, and you flip over and they pin you. And because I'm thinking it's television, I need to get out of the ring. So when I started moving, Ron Simmons just started headbutting me right out of the ring because he realized that I'm getting up way too fast. So they had to make it look somewhat realistic. Yeah. Anyways, Butch Reed just keeps staying on me and, you know, just putting his finger in my chest and stuff. And I'm profusely apologizing. I'm like, Butch, I am so sorry, man. I had no idea. I thought, and he's like, F that. And it just got to the point where there's a certain switch that I think everyone has where you can take it for so long and then you just go, F you. You know what I mean? And then I push him, we square off. And we're about to go at it right here in the dressing room. And Sid Vicious steps in between us. And I didn't even know Sid, but he somehow respected me or something. And he just goes, hey, man, he's a good guy, man. Butch, come on, man, it's not worth it. And he just kind of calmed it down. Next thing you know, they said, Dusty needs to see you. Dusty was the booker at the time. And I'm thinking, that's my last trip here, you know? And I'm walking down the hall to see Dusty. And he comes out and he goes, hey, kid. I go, Dusty, I am so sorry, man. I didn't even realize. I start apologizing to him. He goes, what are you talking about? He goes, hey, kid, anybody ever tell you, you look like Little Richard? And I'm thinking, I thought he was talking about a wrestler, Little Richard. So I just said, Dusty, I never heard of a wrestler, Little Richard. He goes, no, not a wrestler. You know, the singer, a wop, a loom, a wop, the singer, Little Richard. I said, gosh, I never heard that before. He goes, oh, I think I got a gimmick for you. And the next thing you know, my whole career takes off. You know, I mean, I go from this enhancement, guys. I did a few more enhancement jobs for television. Then Dusty took me off television because he wanted to, you know, let time go by. And also I come back as this character, Johnny B. Badd, which I never thought I looked like until Terry, who was at the time, I think it was Dustin's fiance, Terry Reynolds, she eventually married Dusty, and she became Marlena. She was the makeup artist for WCW at the time, and she had me in the chair, and she did up my hair and makeup and everything else, and she spins me around the chair where I look in the mirror, and I go, holy shit, I look like Little Richard. And it's like something Dusty saw that, you know, no one else saw at the time. But the character, you know, it took off in the sense of just, you know, being so crazy. And of course, then I put a lot of time and effort into it, you know, coming up with the Bad Blaster and the kiss that don't miss and working with the Muhammad Ali, the Little Richard character. It was a lot of fun. And, you know, the greatest memories I have from that time in WCW or any time in wrestling was Dusty would have me go to the arena early and he'd work with me on how to walk and talk like Johnny B, like what he perceived as being Johnny B. Badd. And, you know, Dusty was the most flamboyant wrestler ever, just about, you know. So he'd come out and go, I want you to walk up to the microphone and you go, I'm so pretty. I should have been born a little girl. And I get laughing because here I am, former boxer from New York, doing this feminine portrayal. So I get laughing and I try to do it. He goes, oh, no. And I finally get it. And he'd hug me and we get laughing. And I got to tell you, there's some of the greatest memories to have that mentor and that friend work with me so much, to bring out the character that he envisioned in me to do that character. And it was a lot of fun. And I did it for 5 or 6 years at WCW.
It turned out phenomenal. I know, and I could see how hard you worked at it to get that character over, which it got over huge throughout the whole TBS, the Saturday night shows, the big events they would have on the weekends, the they called them PLEs now, but it's pay-per-views. But again, you mentioned the Bad Blaster, but I was doing a little research and I happened to catch this clip. Speaking of the kiss that doesn't miss, where you put a pair of lips on Ted Turner and Jane Fonda and they were at ringside. Absolutely classic. Who would get away with that?
The deal was I was supposed to put it on just Jane, you know? And I said, you know what? It's television. You know, I hope he's got a great sense of humor. And I put him on both. If I can remember correctly, I think I put him on both.
Yes. And, yes.
It was just, and I would say, he's so pretty, but not as pretty as me. and it's a kiss that don't miss, man. And, you know, it was funny because, you know, I would beat the guy with a knockout punch and then put the lips on him and then pin him in a kind of a funny way and just say, that's the kiss that don't miss. I'm pretty and he's ugly, you know.
I'm telling you, it was great. It was so over. I could just see the crowd as you were doing everything you just mentioned. I guess my question is, did you think that after all of your wins and championships, did you feel like that character was just too big for WCW? Did you feel like the character had just gotten bigger than actually the part of the company?
You know, I often think that if that character ever was in the WWE at that time or WWF at that time, I think would have really taken off. Cause they even had Little Richard perform at one of the WrestleManias, you know? Yeah. So how much fun would that have been? it's weird when you go, I wish this or wish that, you know, but never look at life with regrets. You know, I look at life as like all the paths and different things that happened, good or bad, led to where I am today. And I couldn't be more blessed and happier in life that every day I just wake up, I look up and I just thank God for another day. I pray that every single day, thank you, Lord, for another beautiful day, whether it's raining out or not, I'm shining, man. And I pray his love and light shine through me in some way, somehow, that I can be a blessing to somebody else.
Well, we thank you for joining us. Honestly, it's a ray of sunshine to have you on our show. So thank you, Mark. Now I'm going to take you back. So 1991, you make the debut as Johnny B. Badd. You've got this big, flamboyant Little Richard-esque character, and they pair you with legendary manager Teddy Long. Have we got any Teddy stories? Teddy is a unique character, and I want to hear about Teddy Long.
You know, we had so many different gimmicks going. Our entrance was often longer than the matches ever were. And, you know, we started doing, bringing the boxing thing in where we had the hand mitts. Teddy would hold the hand mitts and I'd do 1, 2, 3. And I'd do a left hook and he always made it so the glove would fly off, you know. And it just looked like I had so much power, you know. But we danced before the matches. Just so much fun. I think the hardest part about with Teddy managing me was that we both realized they split us up way too soon. You know, we were just getting, the rocket ship was just taking off. And we were such a great team together that I can't imagine what more we could have done if we stayed together a little bit longer, but they wanted to split us up. And we never really understood why, because it was working really well. And they turned me babyface right away too. I mean, it was just a few months in, and all of a sudden I'm going from this heel character to this baby face, because when I'm coming out, it's like a party, you know, you're shooting confetti and, you know, on television, I would load my confetti gun with real money, you know, fives and tens. And Brian, the funniest thing is that, you know, people go crazy to grab the money and they'd see all the confetti falling down. Well, when I'd go to house shows, I had fake money. It was a picture of Johnny B. Badd, and it would say, "In Johnny we trust," and it'd be $1,000 bill, but it's fake money, you know. So I'm shooting out and people are scrambling to get this fake money because they saw it on television where people are holding up, you know, like fives and $10 bills, or even sometimes a 20 I'd put in there. But I would shoot it off, and it really became a iconic thing with the, and then to get it so it goes further and further, and streamers coming down and all kinds of things are twirling, and it just got so outrageous. Then we bring in the frisbees, you know, I'm a bad man, and hold that up and shoot them out. So I don't know, it just and then the other thing was I would spend so much money on costumes. And Brian, if you remember our first year in WCW, it was like small salary. Like you get they give you a guaranteed contract, but it was only like, well, 75,000. So you might make 7,500 grand your first year, which, you know, a lot of money, but not in wrestling. It really wasn't, you know, but I would spend all that money on my costumes. And, you know, I don't know if you know, Brian, that I hired Sandra Gray, who is the top seamstress in WWE and everywhere. I mean, she only does certain people's clothes now, like Cody Rhodes and a few others. Jade Cargill, but she was, what we did was we put an ad in the paper for a person who makes costumes. She made costumes for little kids dancing. She never did wrestling. And she came over to our home and I said, this is what I need. And that's where the cape started coming out and all the crazy costumes. But I invested in myself. And if I could ever tell any wrestler, man, if you really believe in what you're doing, invest in yourself. Put your money into you and it's going to pay off later. Because eventually, when they signed me to my big money contract, they also gave me like $100,000 for just costumes. Wow. Like everything I could have made, they would pay for, which was investing in yourself and seeing how it was working.
See, that's being creative, though, and thinking outside the box and reinvesting in yourself, which is, I mean, you did it. And again, I know Sandra. Yes, Sandra was did amazing work. She actually did my Wrath outfits in WCW. So I'm very familiar with Sandra, sweetheart of a lady, and her work is the best. I just don't, I've yet to see anyone that top her designs and all she, and look at your work. I mean, your stuff was amazing. I want to ask you, Mark, you know, you had in your tool set of moves and your arsenals. Okay. You had a lot of great stuff, including all your knockout punches. But the one thing that caught my eye going back, doing the research this week, and I, even back in the 90s, I remember you did a sunset dive, which is a sunset flip off the top rope to your opponent who was in the center of the ring. I mean, talk about precision. That one, like I did a lot of high flying stuff for a big guy, but that's one that I would never touch. I don't know why I was worried about getting spiked, but when you did it, it was so smooth. Were you ever worried about that?
You know,
with the height and the distance,
I've always been kind of a daredevil. You know, when I was younger, we used to go to this place called Green Lakes up in central New York, and the lake had diving boards, you know, two low ones and a high one. And we'd go up there and we'd try doubles. And that's where the Marisol came in, where you jump, turn around and hit the ring and do a backflip. That's where it came from, was when I was a kid doing it off diving boards. And of course, the wild thing, which is a shooting star press, we used to do those inverted flips all the time off the diving board. So when I came to doing something in wrestling, like the sunset flip was, I would tell my opponent, you know, when I knock you down, when you slowly get up, make sure you're in the center of the ring. And they go, isn't that a little far? I go, no, make sure. I love to fly as far as I can, man. And I will nail it. Now, there's one time I did miss it. I was wrestling Vader, and Vader was in the center of the ring, like I asked him to be. And I came off the thing and I overshot him because I wanted to make it look spectacular, you know, like just go as high as I could, as far as I could. And I completely missed him and just landed on my back, you know. And then he, you know, the professional he was just came over and just jumped up and kind of Samoan sat me or whatever you want to call it, you know.
Wow. I just want to, you know, I know your toolbox was loaded with great stuff, but that was just one that always looked so impressive to me.
Thank you.
Yeah,
the arsenal was so diverse and way ahead of its time. I mean, you're such an innovator when it comes to top rope maneuvers. We used to pop as fans so much when we got to see them. But just before we broach a little bit more into your moveset and into the feuds that you had in WCW, I want to ask you a little question, because through doing my research, there was something that I uncovered that I knew nothing about. And then I've been watching interviews where you've been talking about it. But is this true that obviously with the connection of Little Richard, that you were actually planning to do a sitcom with?
Well, we actually filmed the sitcom. We shot the pilot and Little Richard was negotiating. It was written by Barry Vigon, who wrote Seinfeld. So he's an amazing writer from Los Angeles. And he came in and he wrote the
pilot.
The pilot, yes. He wrote the pilot, and we filmed the sitcom, but we couldn't do it with Little Richard because we just had a stand-in, because he was still negotiating a contract, whether he was going to do it or not, but he was going to play my father. And what it was is that I owned a gym called The Main Event, which was really a gym in Atlanta and Marietta that Sting and Lex Luger own. And so we got their permission to call the sitcom The Main Event. And the idea was I played myself, Johnny B. Badd, and my father, Little Richard, would run the gym while I was on the road wrestling. And of course, he would get in all kinds of trouble. He'd do stupid things. He'd bring hookers in at night and have parties. And it was a really funny written sitcom. But unfortunately, it never got picked up or never went any further than us shooting the pilot. But we had a lot of fun doing it. And I was really hoping that I would have been able to work with Little Richard. And I don't know if you guys read the part in the book yet that Clarence Santani was Little Richard's driver back in the day. And, you know, I never knew if Little Richard even liked the character Johnny B. Badd. I never met him. Now, I did see posters of him or pictures of him holding my poster up. And he'd say things like before a concert, he'd say, "They say he's pretty. He's not as pretty as me." And he'd rip up the poster. So I never really knew if he liked it or just made fun of it. I'm not sure. Anyways, later on, I meet Clarence Santani, and we've actually become good friends. He actually came to my presentation a couple months ago in Nashville to see one of my events. And we hung out after him, and he was telling me stories about driving Little Richard, and Little Richard would just love seeing me on TV. He'd get such a kick out of it. He thought it was so hilarious, you know, that this big buff wrestler is playing him, you know? So I was really glad to know that he did enjoy it and that we were very close to getting a sitcom picked up, but you know, the way it worked out, it didn't happen.
Yeah, but you still got to meet a friend in the process of it. And you know, you know that Little Richard pretty much embraced the character, which is great. I mean, that's just really a cool little nugget to know, you know?
Yeah. And any publicity is good publicity when it comes to Little Richard, right?
Yes, yes. You know, I also, one of the crazy things too is Michael Jackson loved the character Johnny B. Badd. So when Michael Jackson was doing a concert in Atlanta, he wanted to meet me. And so I don't know, as people called the CNN Center or whatever, however it worked out. But anyways, they sent me down there and I was all dressed up in my Johnny B. Badd regalia, you know, for not for wrestling, but for like just going out to whatever, you know. It was like a white tuxedo with tails and, you know, all glittered and everything. And so he wants to meet me. So I go into his dressing room and it's just him. And he used to hang out with this little kid, Kevin Manuel Lewis, who was played Webster. I don't know if you remember the show Webster. So yeah. It was just them two and me. And I walk in and I couldn't believe how nervous he was meeting me, where I'm like, you know, at that time, this is like 1995 or four, somewhere around there, where he's the biggest superstar. I mean, there's only maybe a couple other people on the planet that are more recognizable than Michael Jackson, you know? And so I'm meeting Michael Jackson and he was like lost for words. And then he just goes, "I really like your costumes." And I go, "Well, thank you. Do you want it?" You know? Anyways, he called me up on stage and I had my Bad Blaster all loaded and everything. And so a Gladys Knight was there too. So he called me and Gladys Knight up on stage. And I thought, what a great time. Let me give Gladys the Bad Blaster. And I have the picture of her shooting that Bad Blaster off to the fans in Atlanta with Michael Jackson, man. Just incredible opportunity to meet so many. And, you know, Brian, you've been the same thing. We've gone to matches where celebrities would come because they want to bring their kids to see us.
Right.
And we'd meet celebrities that we otherwise would have never met if we weren't in this business.
Very true. Just like all the big pay-per-views, the WrestleManias, we would get to meet superstars from music, television, movies, the works. It was great. It says we've all had some great interactions with some amazing people. So been blessed.
Who was the greatest superstar that you met that left you a good feeling inside? You know, they say don't ever meet your hero, you know, but have you ever met someone that you really enjoyed meeting that, I don't know, was set that apart, like someone special?
Well, the first one that comes to mind is Burt Reynolds.
Okay.
Because I would actually, I met him a few times. Actually, I filmed a movie with him in 2004. So that was really fun. And he's a Florida State guy. So we chatted up about football and stuff. And then Chuck Norris was another, just a list of really cool people that really wanted to, you know, be a part of the package as far as the big shows go. They loved it. And NFL Hall of Famers that would come to a lot of the Green Bay Packers and Reggie White and those guys would, like you said, bring their families to the shows. And they loved it. And of course, me as a Green Bay Packer fan, I would get to, you know, go to the locker room and the weight room and, you know, get to check out all the history of the Packer organization. I'm going to shift it back to pro wrestling here, because I want to ask you this. That's one of the questions I had for you, Mark. With all of the top stars that you've worked with in this business, Steve Austin, Brian Pillman, DDP, Arn Anderson, a huge list of stars. During your WCW title runs, the TV title championship, with all those veterans on the roster, did you find it hard to break through the ceiling of the next level as far as a main event?
That's a great question, Brian. You know, you kind of hit the nail right in the head, because I was right in that sweet spot where here I am wrestling Steve Austin, was stunning Steve back then.
Correct.
I'm wrestling him for the U.S. title over and over again, and I'd win, but it was always won on disqualification, so he retained the belt. And then when I win the world television title, I'm wrestling against, you know, the Arn Andersons, the Steve Regals, and just not getting to that next level. Yes. You know, where you're getting that shot with Sting and Lex Luger, although I have wrestled them, but not in like a championship a caliber match. You know, the closest I came was when Rick Rude was the world champion. I got to wrestle Rick Rude, and Rick Rude gave me everything. He made me shine like I have never shined before. He would just call like clothesline, drop kick, backdrop. I mean, it was like I was just making him look bad almost, you know, but he was calling the match and just made me look like a superstar, and eventually just, you know, slip on the banana peel and he'd win the match. But I always never got to that next level, you know, where I in that sweet spot of I mean, I was in a sweet spot, but not that upper echelon that I wanted to be in or was hoping to get to at some point. And that's one of the reasons why I left to go to the WWE, is because I was more or less promised a better opportunity there.
That's really interesting. Honestly, it's very, very true what they say when there is a glass ceiling, and it's so difficult to try and smash your way through it. And as you progressed in your career and did go to the WWF, I do feel that ceiling was smashed. But we're bringing it back to WCW. We are all getting funky with Johnny B. Badd right now. I'm feeling it in my heart. I'm feeling it in my soul. One of the big feuds that I always reflect back to whenever I'm thinking about Johnny B. Badd was the wrestler versus boxer match with Arn Anderson. They were some unique visions on my television set. Let's talk about that.
Arn hated them. You know, the thing was is that, okay, Arn is one of the funniest guys. People don't realize how funny Arn Anderson is, because he would be in the locker room, he would make jokes and stuff, but he wouldn't laugh at his own jokes, so it even made it funnier in a sense, you know? He's one of them straight comedians, but I really had a great relationship with Arn as a friend and as a wrestler. And he was one of those guys that was all about business. Like, if he was to put you over, it's about business. It's not about going to the office and saying, you know, this guy's brand new, he's green, you know. But it wasn't, Arn wasn't like that at all. And he was very, very helpful, really instrumental in helping me get better and better. He always had some great ideas too. But I'll never forget in the match, I think it was Hamilton, what's the referee? Oh gosh, Jody Hamilton's son. Nick Patrick's in the ring, and we're doing the boxer versus wrestler match, and I'm hitting Arn with some lefts to the body and some rights, and you know, and he's trying to cover up, and of course Nick separates us then, you know, and he says, Arn, you know, the referee would give you some insight on what's the next move is or the next spot is. And Nick says to me, he goes, Arn said to punch him in the face as hard as you can. I go, why would he want me to punch him in the face as hard as I can? He goes, he said your working punch is killing him. I was just, I mean, he could make them go to the middle of a match, you know? And in other words, lighten up, man. You know, here I am throwing these bombs on him, you know? And, you know, because I got gloves on, so I'm thinking I'm not hurting him, but I'm really laying him in there to make the sound effect and everything. But it was, Arn could take something like that, which was so ridiculous, and make it look so much fun. Because the finish was my trainer Rock Finnegan was his name that we used, would put a bucket on his head. I'd hit him with a Tutti Frutti, and the bucket's spinning on Arn's head, and his head's doing this, and then Arn goes out, and I end up winning the match. But there's so many great memories with that guy. And I just did his podcast, so we reminisce on some of them too, on how much fun we had to get.
So many iconic moments, so many wonderful friendships. And before I bat over to Brian, who's going to ask you about your path out of WCW, another one of the wonderful friendships that you formed is with the legendary DDP, who you are still big friends with now, and a big proponent of DDPY. It's why we're rocking the bling today, as I'm a proud member of the 100,000 club. I'm a big user of DDPY, and will sing its praises from every rooftop in Manchester. But I just wanted to talk a little bit about DDP with you, and obviously your history with him, and where he finds himself today as truly a light side of the ring. Everybody likes to talk about the dark side of the ring, and it's wonderful for us here on The Meltdown, we're a very positive show, to showcase so many people who embody the light side of the ring. Let's have a little chat about DDP.
Well, there's some good news and some bad news, okay? I made the mistake of moving 20 minutes down the road from DDP, okay? Because now it's like, hey, Mark, come on, let's do the ice plunge. Let's do this. Let's do that. I'm like, damn. And Brian will tell you that the ice plunge, when you first do it, the first time I go over to Dallas's home to do the ice plunge, I'm always over there doing stuff, working out or whatever, okay? And now he just bought a new home in Florida, but he keeps this one here. So he's here half the year in Florida, half the year. So I have a half year rest now, okay? So he says, let's do the gauntlet today. And I'm like, okay. See, me and him have always been so competitive. Like, I try to out push up him, out sit up him. We go crazy on each other. Cause like, I'll give you an example. We do DDPY pushups, which are 10 seconds up. You hold it 10 seconds, 10 seconds down, you hold it. And so it's really like 60 seconds or 30 seconds is one pushup. Okay. And if you get like 10 or 12, that's like incredible. Like, it's amazing if you could do that many. And that son of a gun would beat me in those things. And I went into training on him. Like, I would do them every day. And so I went over his house and I blew him away, right? And he's like, where did you come up with this, you know? And I was like, so we have that mindset against each other. Of course, he's since won it back, you know? We have this, like, this imaginary belt that we're going for. Anyways, long story short, he comes over, he says, let's do the gauntlet today. So I go to his house, and it's a day in Atlanta. There's frost on the ground. It's that cold outside. And, of course, his ice bucket is outside that you got to go into, you know? And so we go outside. I just got shorts on, you know, it's freezing. So I'm sitting there waiting. And I go, okay, let me get in this thing. He goes, let me explain this whole thing to you, why you're doing this. And he starts telling me stories about getting into the ice plunge, why it's so good for inflammation and why it's good for this and good for your heart and good for your brain and good. And I'm going, Dallas, let me just get in there. He goes, but you got to tell me a story, because this is your first time. It's really difficult. And I said, well, how long do I got to stay in? He says, 3 minutes. Now, it's freezing outside. Okay. I get in this thing, and you got to go right up to your neck. Okay. You go slide all the way down into this big tub, and you go right up to your neck. And Brian, I don't know if you remember your first time. It's like, You think you're going to die, because it's like you've never experienced anything this cold this long. You know, even if it's 30 seconds, it's like longer than you've ever experienced something this cold. Yeah. I did 2.5 minutes my first time, but Dale's is telling me to tell stories. So he goes, tell me a boxing story. So I remember a match I was talking to him about, you know, fighting this guy back in the day. And I'm telling the story and I'm out of the story. And all of a sudden I realize, oh my gosh, this is, I don't know if this is healthy for me. Like, it gets to the point where you like don't know if it's going to go the opposite way. And I did 2.5 minutes. I got out. And then we go right into the DDPY workout with the cuffs on, you know, the power cups.
Yeah.
And then we go into the oxygen tank where you get on a bike with an oxygen mask on and he shuts off your oxygen. And I'm like, Dallas, I know you never got to beat me in WCW, but why are you trying to kill me now? But he is one of the greatest, man. I tell you, he's an inspiration. You know, the other day I was just telling him about I've had five shoulder surgeries, you know, and I was telling them, man, my shoulders are like so stiff, you know, and I'm trying to like stretch them. And he goes, hey, bro, this is what you got to do. And he goes out, and now he's in Florida right now. So he goes out on his deck in Florida, and he makes like 5 videos to send me. And each one's like a minute, minute and a half long. I'm thinking, what friend takes that kind of time because he's concerned about your health? And that's the kind of guy he is. And he's working with Lex right now. And yeah. And coincidentally, I mean, the two guys I chose to write my forward to the book, Lex and DDP, and it just so happens DDP inducts Lex into the WWE Hall of Fame. So what a blessing, man, to have two friends that wrote such nice things about me that then worked together and are working together right now to get Lex to someday walk again.
It comes full circle, truly unstoppable. We are sending all our love out to DDP. And thank you so much for DDPY. It's helped me so much. I've dropped about 32 pounds with DDPY and feel blessed from it. So thank you very much. Everybody, I would definitely go out your way, check it out, download the app, give it a little try. Try that 7-day trial. It is well worth it. We're going to share this on the DDPY social pages to just let you know that we've all got your back.
But if he invites you over for the gauntlet, say you're busy that day, okay?
I feel Brian messages me every morning he's done the ice plunge.
Yes, this is where he does not treat his friends fairly, okay?
I do it every morning, man. I love it. I've almost 15 months of it now. And the only days I really miss is if I have an event like, you know, WrestleCon, which was in Vegas for 3 or 4 days. So I did miss it during that time, which I wish, you know, you can, if you get dedicated to it, your body really gets acclimated to it. And it's just so beneficial. Yes. I swear by it. I haven't been sick. I haven't had a cold, any of those things. So I feel it's definitely a big positive. I know Tom has some questions we talked about. We gave you some questions prior to this show.
Yeah.
So Tom, I want to ask you real quick, and you can just, because I sort of think we know the answer to it, but what was your decision to leave WCW? Was it sort of like you said, getting to that ceiling and not being able to get to that next level? And because we would love to do a part two with you as far as the WWF/WWE run, sure. But leaving WCW in 96, what was the catalyst for that?
You know, I also recently done Eric Bischoff's 83 Weeks podcast. And, you know, people always thought that me and him, you know, obviously we had words that day that I left, and it was kind of, you know, and he was such a good friend too, you know, and it was kind of a bad situation because of me leaving, and he had a nice big contract there for me guaranteed. But when Vince topped that and gave me a big signing bonus, and I was the first wrestler to get a guaranteed contract at WWE or WWF back then. And I not only was it that I always thought that I want to end my career there. Like going to the dance is wrestling at WrestleMania. That's the dance. And anybody that's ever been in our business would say, I want to be at WrestleMania. I mean, that is like, you made it to the dance. And I've always wanted to go there, and I've always wanted to finish my career there. And it just gave me the opportunity. And remember at that point in 1996, I'm close to 37 years old. And I know I'm at the twilight of my career, maybe 3 or 4 more years left really. And I wanted to finish it there. And so when I went there, and I think Vince was thinking that he was going to be getting somewhat something similar to Johnny B. Bad. But Brian, you remember the lawsuits going back and forth back then, you know, everybody that was jumping ship in the middle. You're seeing guys on the same show, both the same night, you know, it's crazy. Yeah. So, we had to come up with something completely different. And when you go to WWF and they have creative, you think of how they invented, you know, the greatest characters ever that made lots of money. What do you got for me, you know? And I'll never forget, and I don't know if you guys want to save this for the next one, but I'll just start with saying that Vince McMahon said to me, what do you think of Wild Man Mark Merrill? And I thought for a second, and I'm thinking, they must know what they're doing. What's wild, man? He goes, can you do a Tarzan yell? And I said, Vince, I don't have a very strong voice. In fact, when I yell, my voice like crackles, you know, it's like, I just can't yell loud, you know? And I said, I don't get, now he's thinking like Sting doing the woo or Ric Flair woo or whatever, you know, I don't know. So I'm thinking, you know, I can't do that. So I said, I can't do that. And then he goes, and then they started bringing out drawings of what they wanted to render this character, Wild Man Mark Merrill. And I'm looking at him, I go, am I from the jungle? Like, what is Wild Man Mark Merrill? So I never really connected with it like I did with Johnny B. Badd, because Johnny B. Badd was so opposite of who I am. It's just fun. Like, it's like you're going to a play every day, you know? But this was totally different. And it was because I kind of wanted to use my own character, but I'm from jungle. I don't know. It was just never really, really connected with it. And when you don't connect with your character, the audience is never going to connect with it, and never happened. And then you're bringing out this beautiful girl with you every time. Who are they going to be cheering for but the person that you're with, you know? So it all worked out for the best. You know, when you really look at the whole thing, how everything turned out, man, it all worked out for the best.
Do you think that there is genuinely a box of gimmicks where he's formulated this particular character and he is just looking for the right individual to slot them into that particular narrative? Because I know from Brian's experience, there was a couple of different characters that you were offered before settling on Adam Bomb, right?
Yes. Yes. They pitched a military character, which I'm a veteran, so that sort of made sense. But they also pitched the very first part of The Ringmaster, which would later be given to Steve Austin. But that was the three. It was Adam Bomb, a military character, and The Ringmaster. Those were the three for me, with the drawings and everything. Some of it was pretty wild. Like The Ringmaster had a top hat and he had a big whip and just, you know, some things. Just, you've got to be able to connect with some of that stuff. And I just felt of the three personally, I could connect with the one I chose, which was Adam Bomb, of course. So
yeah. I tease him that he'd have made a great gobbledygooker.
Yeah.
Only.
You know, guys, going back to WCW, when Dusty Rhodes first came up with the character, the Little Richard lookalike character, I've only shared this a couple of times, but you know what the name that he gave me was? Precious. That was my name. And I was like, oh man, it's the worst name ever. So I remember going home that day and thinking, and I started thinking about the era of Little Richard. And I started just researching, and I saw, I think it was it Chuck Berry that sang Johnny Be Good? I think it was. There was someone that sang Johnny.
I think it was.
And Dallas was doing this, you know, thing with Michael Hayes and the Freebirds, you know, the B-A-double-D, you know. And I said, call Dallas. I go, hey, Dallas, would you mind if I use the name Johnny Be Bad, B-A-D-D? Because he was doing the, you know, B-A-double-D, you know. And I said, sure, man, that's a cool name. So I'll never forget this. I go, because Dusty was set on Precious. And I was like, oh my gosh, I don't know that. So I said to Dusty, I go, Dusty, I know you really like that name Precious, but would you mind if I give you another option? He goes, what do you got? I go, think of this. Back in the Little Richard era, you remember the song Johnny Be Good? And since I'm going to be a heel, how about Johnny Be Bad, B-A-double-D? And he goes, I like it. I go, thank you, Lord. Oh my gosh. I can't imagine going to conventions today and going, hey, Precious.
Oh yeah. You're that close to being Precious Mark Merrill, man. Wow.
But just from that, an icon was born. And we're going to talk about some WCW icons in a moment. But my final question before we put a nice big bow on it is, obviously you set forth on a nice little trip for Stanford and were there for maybe what, 3 years, something like that? 96, 97, 98.
I just signed a new 3-year contract when we were leaving. So I had another guaranteed contract for 3 more years at the same price, even though the character wasn't getting over. And well, then again, Sable got over huge. So it was like, we don't want to lose her. So keep this guy quiet and just sign him to another 3-year contract, you know? But yes, I was there for 3 years, and then we ended up leaving.
Well, we're definitely going to have you back on. You are always welcome to take that hot tag from us to join us. We want to talk about Marvelous Matt Maron, obviously the Wild Man. There's so many questions. You debuted on the same night the Ultimate Warrior returned. I want to know what it was like to share a locker room with him as a person. I want to talk about maybe a proposed feud with Mr. Perfect, who obviously cheated you out of your Intercontinental title with Triple H. There's so much that we can talk about, and we've not even mentioned Sable, but there's loads. So, but I would just want to put a nice big bow on WCW with a one-shot deal that happened in 2000 when you were sat in the crowd, and it was with Tank Abbott. Why was it only a one-night deal? What was the crack with that?
Well, I mean, the idea was that I was going to come back to, you know, work a program with Tank and possibly, you know, sign a deal with WCW, but it never materialized because at that time my ex wanted to really get into doing movies too. And so we rented a place in Studio City, California, and we rented it for 1 year, saying if we can't make it in 1 year, then, you know, then we'll pack up our bags and do something else. And that's one of the reasons why I didn't sign with them or stay with them. And I don't really know how much interest there really was. I would think they wanted to see how it went. And I don't know if Tank Abbott didn't continue. I don't really remember what happened then. But I just remember that we still had other things that we wanted to accomplish and do. And we tried to do. Oops, sorry about that, guys. So.
Okay. It was so. Would they have brought you back as Johnny B. Bad? Was that going to be?
I believe so. Yeah, I mean, okay. That's what they knew me as then at WCW, and there's just so many things that have happened after I left WCW with WWE, you know, including Vince having me shave all my hair off. If you remember that,
yeah,
you know, I had to come back bald, and it's like it just was not. There was just so many things that you just shake your head and you look back and you go, what the hell were they thinking, you know? But you always believe that they know what they were doing. They had this vision. And I'll never forget when I shaved my head bald, just like they asked me to do. I come on TV and they go, yeah, Vince, why don't you grow your hair back? It's like, is this a rib? I mean,
yeah.
I had this long flowing hair, man, for years. And I shave it all off. And next thing you know, I got to grow it all back again. So just crazy things like that. You just never really understood, but you, if you're a team player, you go by what they say.
Yeah. And you're working on the basis that you think that there's something beautiful at the end of that rainbow. And sometimes
you do. And you know, and here I am getting this. Remember, the guys are getting paid off the houses and we weren't drawing really great then. And here I am getting this big guaranteed contract. And not only that, then I blow out my knee and I'm out for 8 months sitting home making that big paycheck every week. And it did not sit well with guys. And I never even realized it as much as I understood later on how it affected other wrestlers working with me, that they didn't really want to put me over or they didn't really want to work well with me because I'm making all this money and they're getting paid on whether the house. I mean, Mick Foley and Steve Austin signed weeks or months before me. And then all of a sudden I come in and I get this big guaranteed contract and a big signing bonus. And I got to bring my wife with me and, you know, get all these stipulations where other guys are, you would never be able to bring their wife on the road. And remember, it was never brought in that she was going to be part of the team. She was just brought in because I wanted her traveling with me. I didn't want to get a divorce. I seen how divorces were. And I said, no, I'm going to do everything I can keep my marriage strong. So I want my wife to come with me. And I pitched to Vince and I said, since she's going to be with me, because when he finally agreed to it, I said, since she's going to be with me, why don't we make her my valet? He goes, oh, no, let's just worry about you. And then when we flew to Stanford to sign my contract and go over creative, when he saw her, the first thing he said is I got to put her on television. And that's how Sable, that day we came up with the name Sable. That's how it was born.
Incredible. Incredible. Brian, I'm going to lay it up for you, brother. Because I'm going to put the focus on you and I'm going to put the focus on Mark, because the next question I've got is a question for you both. So as we're leaving WCW, as we do with all our wonderful guests, and I've thrown this question out to Brian numerous times with different topics, I want you guys to name your Mount Rushmore of WCW talent. So you got to pick four. Who's going to be the four faces that you would make a Rushmore out of World Championship Wrestling? Brian, I'm going to ask you to hold on. Mark's going to go first.
Okay.
Let's see where you stretch.
You got to go with Sting. You got to go with Ric Flair. Wow, that's a tough one, man. I'm going to say Ron Simmons because he became the first Black heavyweight champion. It really broke the glass ceiling, so that he deserves to be up there. And one more. I would say Stone Cold for WWE, but we're talking WCW, though. Yeah. So one more. Let's think. What was really over? Wow, this is a tough one, man. The fourth one.
No hints or anything like
that. I'm going to say Rick Rude.
Great choices.
I like Rick Rude because he treated me real good, and he was a hell of a worker, man.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Solid. So how does that compare to yours, Brian?
3 out of 4. He was going okay.
I think he's going to change Rick Rude to someone else. That's what I think.
And I actually thought about Rude as being my fourth. I was just trying to think of the eras, you know. But yeah, Sting, of course, I agree. Flair, Ron Simmons. But I went just for the impact that he made while I was there. Would be Bill Goldberg.
Oh, see, I never wrestled with Bill Goldberg. I was never there with Bill Goldberg. But yeah, that would obviously, if you're talking WCW. I'm thinking of just the people that I was with when I was there. Yes, Bill Goldberg definitely deserved to be on there. Yeah, that was just an incredible streak he had, and the intensity that he would come out to, and it was amazing. It was really, he broke the glass ceiling on a whole nother level of a guy that, you know, didn't really work a match too much. He didn't need to, you know. I mean, when people dog him out for not being a good wrestler and how Steve Regal exposed him and stuff, but man, he didn't have to. I mean, if you're doing that well and the crowd is with you, it's all about, you know, drawing money and people paid to see that guy.
Yeah. I loved working him in WCW and in All Japan. I worked with him. He was amazing. He was so over. I mean, just that run he had, like he's the undefeated streak, massively over. So yes.
We share the same three, Brian. We share three.
Correct. We got 3 out of 4. That's okay, though. That was great.
That's good. There's a mash, but there's one that I would exchange, and we love Ron Simmons. He has got a place in my heart, but the American Dream takes the
fourth. Oh, man, yeah. See, I shouldn't say this. I did wrestle Dusty Rhodes. One of the last matches Dusty ever had was a tag team match against me and Jeff Jarrett. And I'll never forget this because Dusty was up in age at that time. But I never saw him wrestle in WCW other than films. But I mean, I guess I'm just, when I'm thinking of my Mount Rushmore, I'm thinking of the guys that I was with. But so a funny story, funny Dusty story to kind of end it all with you guys is that we were wrestling. It was me and Jeff Jarrett against Dusty Rhodes and a guy named Russ Rollins. And it was a big outdoor arena where there was about 10,000 people. It was a great turnout. And Dusty was up in age at that point. And so he's going over the match in the dressing room. And he says, you know, his thing was the bionic elbow, right? So he says, now listen, everybody, when I lift my elbow, everybody just fall down. So he just had that sense of humor about him. And I got to take the bionic elbow and I'll never forget it, man. I sold it like I was shot.
Great memories. He is, honestly, we're going to strap a rocket to you and shoot for the moon. He was the man, you will. We love it. Well, before we touch on one of the big features that we are looking to dissect a little bit more about, that is, of course, Bad to Good, Mark's brand new book with the legendary Ben Veal. I've got another question for you guys. And this, again, is going to be going to Brian and it's going to be going to Mark. I'm going to invite you to build the ultimate professional wrestler. And in front of me, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I've got 8 different topics. I'm going to throw those topics out to you, and all I need is a name. That's all I need, just a name, to create the ultimate pro wrestler. So, Mark, I'm going to start with you. I'm going to give you a topic. Brian, I'm going to bat from Mark to you. So it's the same topic for both of you. Okay. Let's kick it off. Right. Building the ultimate wrestler. Who had the best entrance?
Ultimate Warrior.
Boom. Brian.
Good one. But when the glass breaks, Stone Cold Steve Austin.
That's right.
Solid. Athleticism.
Oh man, that's a good one. Eddie Guerrero.
Brian.
Kurt Angle.
These are building some ultimate wrestlers right now. Physique.
Who would you say?
Physique.
I gotta go with Lex Luger and Ultimate Warrior are neck and neck. I'm gonna go with Lex Luger.
Yeah.
Total package,
Lex Luger, yes.
Okay. Super. I like that. Okay, it's good when you mash it. Technique.
Technique. Mr. Perfect, Kurt Hennig.
Eddie Guerrero.
That's true, too.
Mike skills.
WWE Stone Cold Steve Austin.
This guy never seems to get rattled. I got to go with John Cena.
You can't see me. Well, let's see who your finisher would be. Who has the best finish?
The best one, I think, is because it comes out of nowhere, is DDP's Diamond Cutter. Yeah. I love when it just did it out of anywhere. And you never know when it was coming. It would just nail you with it.
I'm going to go Rob Van Dam, 5-star frog splash.
He's one of a kind. And you guys are building ultimate wrestlers that are one of a kind right now. Charisma.
Shawn Michaels.
You know it.
I'm going to go with Flair just for the test of time.
And last but by no means least, ring gear. Who has got the finest ring gear you've ever seen?
That character, Johnny B. Bad.
it was amazing. I thought about that. I'm going to go just a slight difference here and go Rey Mysterio.
Definitely. Brian's not putting you over, Bob.
Oh, hush, Brian. You're lucky I'm not over there because I'd kick your booty with my tutti frutti. I'm bad, no, man.
You had some great stuff. I'm going to tell you, I loved it. Don't get me wrong. It's going to have a little bit of different answers, so it's okay.
I loved it, honestly. And you built two ultimate superstars. We're going to drop that into a reel so everybody can see who your picks were. But we're going to go forward. We've put a nice big bow on WCW. We're going to invite you back to talk about the WWF. But before we get there, we want to touch base on the wonderful Bad to Good that you guys can pick up from Amazon right now. And as Mark said, it'll be with you next day. Get fully stuck in. So talk to us after the massive success of your first book, How to Be the Happiest Man on the Planet. What was the process of deciding on writing a second book?
No, it was actually meeting Ben Veal. You know, he's an award-winning writer. And he just said to me, man, I really would love to write your story. And we started talking on Zoom, and he took stories that I would share with him, and he just bring them to life. He's an amazing writer, and I couldn't be more proud of this book. And that's why I'm reading it again. As I was telling you guys earlier, I'm reading it straight through because it's really an entertaining book, and there's so many great stories in there, and everything from, you know, when you talk about bad to good, I really open up and share things I've never even talked about. You know, my whether it's drug addiction, selling drugs, working with the Colombians, moving drugs from Florida to New York, getting busted, getting my mom's house kicked in, doors broken, SWAT team, all the things I wrote about, and then turning my life around, accepting Jesus as Lord and Savior, and then working at schools and changing lives and working with kids with depression, anxiety, kids that are bullied and abused, and trying to make a difference in their lives. There is no greater joy than helping another person. And it's all in the book. And I think anyone that reads this, anyone that's ever had a broken heart, a divorce, loss of a loved one, going through anxiety or depression, read this book. I got to tell you, you'll see that we can get through these things. You know, after every storm, the sun does eventually shine. Just don't ever, ever give up.
Well, I can tell you now that I'm partially through it now, and I highly recommend it. It just goes, he said, the stories of amazing journey through life, and he continues to give back each and every day. It's available right now on Amazon. Get your copy. I got my copy overnight. And once you start reading, yeah, this has been sort of a nightly read for me as I work my way through the stories. And like Mark says, I mean, it's just amazing some of the stuff that he has been through, and to come out on the other side so much of a better human being and a wonderful person. And I love to hear his stories, and I follow him on all of his social media. And you're doing it right, Mark. Proud of you, man.
Brian, I really appreciate that. And, you know, coming from a five-year-old kid that burnt down his house to now having a beautiful home, I've come a long ways, guys.
On that also now, I just thought about it. Now, you're a big Buffalo Bill fan, right?
Oh, gosh.
So, right? I mean, so huge. For you to get into the Bills Mafia, I'm thinking that maybe you grow back the classic mustache, okay? And you know I have a little tie-in there with my former college teammate, Jeff Wright, who's the nose tackle for the Buffalo Bills during all those Super Bowl runs. So, I mean, how could they not have you as, like, the Buffalo Bills Mafia ambassador? Mark, I'm
involved with the Bills Mafia, and if I throw my mustache back, it's going to be completely white unless I get some Just for Men.
All right. Love it.
But, you know, guys, sitting through those four Super Bowl losses with the Bills, I would actually get to watch them from Jim Kelly's house, because Kevin Kelly is Jim's brother, who is a good friend of mine. So we'd go over his house and watch the games. And that was just one of the heartbreaking things that we've gone through in our life. But I tell you, this could be our year. You know, Josh Allen, the MVP last year, and he's a beast, man.
Yes.
I think that this year could be the year for the Buffalo Bills. They got a little bit easier schedule than normal. I think it's the fifth best schedule in the NFL. So I think they can really, really do well this year. And I'm hoping that they do.
Well, we'll be rooting for them. I will. I don't follow the NFL as much as I did in the past, but just to have that little tie-in from a former college teammate is pretty cool. And I agree with you. I think they are definitely on their way.
It's all about choices. It's all about the choices that the Bills make. And they need to be champions of choices. What a beautiful segue. I want to bat that over and tell us a little bit about that wonderful, wonderful organization that you've put together, the Champion of Choices. Tell us how people can get in touch with you and exactly what you offer to wonderful schools.
This was my 18th year speaking at schools, churches, corporations all over the world. I've been so blessed. I spoke at schools in Guatemala. I even went to Russia and spoke at schools in Russia. Average over 200 events a year. It's been an amazing journey, and I couldn't be more blessed, more proud of what we have accomplished over all these years, and would love to come to your town, your school. If you go to our website, which is just Think Pause, and Pause is POZ as in zebra, thinkpause.org, O-R-G. And but you can find me all over social media. Just type in my name, Mark Merrow, M-A-R-C-M-E-R-O, and you'll find me. And I do my best to answer messages that come to me. So I'm on X, Facebook, all the major platforms. So check it out. And guys, thank you so much. You guys do a great job, man. You guys are fun to talk with and reminisce on some great stories from our past. And I look forward to coming back and talking about the WWE together, because that's when it got a little crazy.
Yeah. Tom, do you have anything you want to wrap up with Mark?
I just want to say a massive thank you. Honestly, it's been an absolute pleasure. You welcomed us with open arms when we came to visit you in Manchester. You embraced my son so much that cool I'm now not your actually son, allowed to read this book. Why I've ordered a second copy.
Yeah. Your son was so cool. You know, you can tell he's so proud of his dad, and you're so proud of him. It's just what a blessing to see that, the love you guys have for each other. It's just, you know, it just reminds me of my father and I, how we were together. And just that was really cool to hang out with you guys that day.
That means the world to me. Thank you so much, Mark.
Yeah, Mark, I want to thank you here at The Meltdown. We want to thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule. We know that you're pushing the book throughout the country, and you're busy constantly over, 200 days of the year, at least, on your appearances and stuff. And we just wish you nothing but the best, man. Success to you and your family. And we wish you nothing but more success on this book. And you working with Ben Veal is a winning combination, no doubt about it. So remember, Mark, if you're ever in the Tucson, Arizona area, you are always welcome, my friend, to get some horseback riding in. Yes. Watch some beautiful sunsets out here. Visit the Old West in a bygone era. You are always welcome, my friend.
Thank you so much. And, you know, I was in Phoenix not too long ago. It was a little distance from where you were, but hopefully I'll get out to your area. And I'd love to see you, man. It'd be great to catch up and get together.
Looking forward to it.
Ladies and gentlemen, he's a bad man with a very good heart. He's Johnny B. Bad, the one, the only, Mark Merrow. What an incredible guest. Honestly, from the heart. It means the world to us here at The Meltdown to have the one, the only. He is a bad man. He's going to knock you out with that tutti frutti. Johnny B. Bad, the one and only Mark Merrow, joining us on this gorgeous Meltdown Monday. Oh, what a pleasure. It was such insightful stories from his time in WCW. And we're going to bring him back to divulge a little bit about what he went through up north. Now, with The Meltdown, we are always evolving, constantly turning things around to create new and inventive features on our show. And right now, I think we've got one that you guys are going to be really excited about. Brian, tell them about the new feature.
Well, we all know how much we love our pets. They're part of the family. I mean, that's just the way it is. And we love them truly. So this coming episode, and you'll be able to see it at the end of this show, and we're going to have some photos and images of the Tomcat and his furry friend, the Creation of Devastation and his furry friends, and our tag team partner, part of the six-man tag team champion, Jonathan O'Dwyer, is going to have his photos of Ernest the Cat, which is his cat. So that's a new feature we're going to add, and of course, we want you guys to be involved with it. So the following week, we're going to take your photos and we're going to pick sort of a pet of the week, if you will, kind of thing where it's fun. We want to see what, you know, let you guys get to know us better. We get to know you better. And we're just glad that you are here. As we grow each and every week, we are loving it and we're doing what we do best. And that's what we call breaking necks and cashing checks right here with the Tomcat from the UK, baby. Get ready for another amazing episode coming your way with marvelous bad man himself, Mark Merrow. Much love from us to you guys. Thank you, and we will see you soon.